o'clock.
Blog.
Free at last. Free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
We'd like to welcome everybody today to On Point with your host, with me, Don Allen, and Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Hey, Mr. Edwards, how's everything going today?
Well, fine, Mr. Allen. It's a nice, somewhat partially cloudy, sunny day here in the Twin Cities, though we've got a snowstorm rolling in later on tonight, early Sunday morning. But a lot of tension, Don Allen, not only across the world. We've been following the events for the last couple of weeks in North Africa and the Middle East, but in our own beloved sister state just next door to us here, Wisconsin. Police now on the scene, separating protesters, if you will. Day five. The protest. Thousands and thousands of left-wingers, we'll do it like that, we'll do it like the United States reports on other countries, have been in the streets. Tea Party activists toting guns showed up this morning, but they are greatly outnumbered. But we're watching very closely. Governor Walker seeming to show some of the frustration of what's happening. The 14 Democratic legislators, or in this case, senators, state senators, Mr. Allen, two of which are black, have not returned to the state of Wisconsin. Last time they were, their whereabouts was known, it was Rockford, Illinois. Some trying to criticize them, but, you know, as far as I'm concerned, as part of the political game, they're just attempting to stop a rushing train, if you will, that will attempt to strip organized labor in the state of Wisconsin and by virtue of the country of their rights, particularly collective bargaining. But we'll probably talk about that a little bit later on. But right now, real sensitive political and military situation for the United States, Mr. Allen, in the Persian Gulf, in Bahrain, where the United States has a massive naval facility there, maintains its warships as a part of its ongoing relationships with oil-producing nations in that part of the world. Bahrain, which is a small island state, ruled by a Sunni monarch with a 70% majority Shiite population. But Bahrain is the close ally, both by politics but also by royal pedigree, to the Saudis. And some information now saying that the Saudis have indicated they will provide troops if the situation so dictates. But it has caught the United States in a terrible position. The Bahrain security forces have killed at least, no one really knows the number, 50, 60, 70 protesters. World opinion is that the United States, the Obama administration, should speak up, take a position. The United States can't do that, Don, because they can't jeopardize their naval base there in Bahrain. Iran, across the Straits of Hormuz, watching and waiting, if you will. By the way, the Iranians send two warships through the Suez Canal, apparently sometime yesterday our time, two warships. The Israelis are, threatening and et cetera. Obviously, the ships are doing what the United States and the great white powers have done for years. And you're a former military man, you know about making a port of call, right?
Yes, oh yes.
Flying the flag, showing the flag, if you will.
On the flag.
Yes, and we probably have not had this since the Chinese started doing it with its naval power. The first real nation of color to ever really do that was the Japanese in the 1920s, 30s, and even before that, showing the flag. But anyways, very, very sensitive situation. In fact, maybe some of our callers may want to give their reflections, because United States military personnel are watching acts of brutality, if you will. Of course, everything is in the eyes of the beholder, right? But watching the Bahrain security forces shooting down folks in the streets. Libya, interesting situation. Muammar Gaddafi, according to the Western media, has unleashed mercenaries within his armed forces over 100 or more are dead. Helicopter gunships in the last couple of hours over some of the protesters and demonstrators and have opened fire. But no one really has, from the Western media, really has the kind of specific detail. Folks are using their iPhones and cell phones and et cetera. You can hear gunfire. You can see certain things happening. But the kind of clarity that you and I know that you must have as a journalist is not in place. But it is clear, the following is clear, Mr. Allen. Libya, Bethron, Yemen, if you will, and a couple of other countries are indicating they do not intend to go quietly into the night. And in the case of the United States' relationship with some of these countries, where this nation, by policy, has allowed these rulers to stay, I mean, Muammar Gaddafi, may peace be upon him, has been the ruler for 41 years, you know what I mean? Hosni Mubarak was the ruler there for 30 years. The United States spoke of him in glowing terms, seemed to forget that, you know, constitutional rights were being violated. But keep your eye on that situation. Now, the reason I've elaborated on that, as you and I know, people watch things, they see things, they hear things, they begin to become tied into things, right?
Yes.
I.e., Madison, Wisconsin.
Yes.
And you could begin to see the first elements, if you will, of a sharply divided nation reminding us of the 1960s, violence in the streets and et cetera. Very, very perilous situation in Madison, Wisconsin right now with respect to what is going on. And what gets me, Don, no one really saw it coming. When I say no one, I'm talking about the people that pretend, and they get large salaries to do it, that they are on top of everything that's going on. Just like the government was caught off guard, what's happening in North Africa, Persian Gulf, and et cetera, it looks like they were caught off guard in Madison. So,
yes,
anyways, sure. Right now across the river, in fact, we're told that a fairly nice number of Minnesotans have been going across the bridges, if you will, at the St. Croix into Hudson, down to Madison and et cetera, in support of the workers, if you will. So
yes.
Kind of reminds me of the times of the Red Tide and the Red Fear in America, 1918, 1920. You know what I'm saying? Keep your eye on it, Mr. Allen, but go ahead. What else we got?
Well, I'd like to let our listeners know, if you'd like to call in, you can dial 877-572-4288, and we are again broadcasting from the beautiful Macintosh Studios in downtown Minneapolis. And with that said, Ms. Edwards, we have a lot of events going on here locally in the Twin Cities, and I guess we need to touch off on a couple of those things. And I was very shocked to see a flyer, Mr. Edwards, produced by State Representative Bobby Joe Champion, 58B, and also State Representative Jeff Hayden announcing a education forum to be held on Tuesday, February 22nd, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Sabathia Community Center.
Ah.
And the reason why I was shocked is because this was sent out on an email blast to people that are part of the Minnesota DFL African American Caucus.
Okay. Let me just say on that point. So, again, transparency. At the conclusion of the meeting that they had about a month ago where at UROC, where they were talking about a light rail, transit rail, and the issue of jobs came up, and we were told again it was premature. They did announce that they would be holding an event on education at Sabathany. They did announce that at the near the conclusion of the meeting at UROC.
Yeah.
I'm like you, I'm a little taken back once again, because I know that in a couple of meetings I've heard some black journalists in our city ask the question of at what point, so that we get good factual information, does the Democratic office holders reach out to their colleagues on the other side of the aisle? And I remember we were told in a meeting at another facility here about 2 weeks ago that all that's premature and doesn't need to happen, et cetera. Now, this event that you're talking about, Mr. Allen, this starts out with we're going to have a social hour with the Commissioner of Education from 6 to 7?
Yeah, there's a little reception from 6 to 7 at the Banquet
okay.
Center. And
okay.
And then from 7 to 8, they're going to hold a forum. And I mean, I'm not Mr. Edwards. Clearly, for full disclosure, I'm not really against this. I'm against. I think that there are people on the other side of the aisle and people that are not a part of the Minnesota DFL African American Caucus that should be at this meeting to address the commissioner.
Such as, let me just cut in, take a prerogative with you, Mr. Allen. Such as the chairs of both the Senate and House committees on education, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Okay.
And, I mean. And, you know, it was really interesting because I actually sent it.
Republicans. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's right. Republicans. I sent it over to a school board director who had no idea the event was even coming and who forwarded it on to the communications department at the Minneapolis Public Schools to make them aware of it.
I see. Okay.
And so it was pretty shocking, you know, because, again, the DFL political plantation, this is an opportunity to include everyone.
I don't understand the role of the Star Tribune here also, who normally carries water for the Republicans, but Corey Mitchell, the education writer for the Minneapolis Star Tribune, was in a meeting 2 days ago with Stan Allen, the communications director of the Minneapolis Public Schools, at 807, which is the address of the district school's headquarters here in Minneapolis, and I assume they would have been talking about this. This obviously would be important to the community, particularly a community / i.e., African-American community of color that has been so violated by the lack of educational success. And I'm just puzzled why the Minneapolis Star Tribune has not reported on this.
Yeah, I mean, you don't hear a word about this stuff. And they're sending out these little not really well-done flyers and these emails. And if someone hadn't forwarded it to me, Mr. Edwards, I wouldn't even known about it because I'm not on the Minnesota DFL African-American Caucus at all whatsoever. But I just feel that this is not just for a particular political group. I think this should be for everybody should be included on this. And again, you have your ringleaders, or as I put it, dog and pony show leaders, Bobby Joe Champion representative, and also Mr. Jeff Hayden.
State representative
was there.
Two of the four that we have here in Minnesota. Yeah.
And it's like they're trying to have a really controlled environment on this. You know, just really.
I have to say my long experience says that that's what that is. Now, that's Tuesday the 22nd. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Tuesday the 22nd at the Bathany Community Center from 6 to 7 is the reception.
Cocktail hour,
yes. And then from 7 to 8, they're going to have the forum.
Let me say this again for our listening audience, both domestic and international, how things are working here right now. You know, both Republicans and Democrats, the Obama administration, others have been talking about jobs. And we on the ground don't see any jobs materializing. And when you look at reports and studies indicate, particularly in this state, black folk don't get work. They don't get jobs. They don't get employment. And they particularly don't get employment at livable salaries, if you will. Now, Tuesday, the 22nd, is a rather interesting day in our beloved Shangri-La. Starting at 7:30, Velma Corvell, the executive director of the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights, is having a closed meeting at the Minneapolis Library, the downtown Central Library, but having a meeting there with members of the Minority Contractors Association who have already agreed that they will not testify to the disparity study, which we have been exclusively talking about here on point since its unveiling in October 21st, if you will. There will be a kind of a closed meeting as they discuss the strategy for the public hearing, which now has been pushed back to the 2nd of March in front
yes.
of the Public Safety Committee. Okay. Then later on in the day, there are some additional meetings. And then also that evening, I think you have documentation. I'm looking across at you there on the computer. There's a coming out introduction for the new head of the UROC facility in North Minneapolis. Is that true also?
Yeah, I've heard that today. By the way, Mr. Edwards, hold that thought. We have a caller here. We might have
Let's get him on. We always want to call us.
Go ahead, caller. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Yeah, this is Bob.
This is who?
Bob.
Hey, Bob, what's happening?
Yeah, I'd like to talk about the article in the Star Tribune about this. Smith theft, and where did the rifle, where did it come from?
I'm sorry, so you say there have been a couple Smiths killed here.
Quincy Smith.
Oh, okay, I understand. Mr. Allen, he's talking about the article also, which we were going to touch on later on, but,
yes.
But we'll certainly respond to any the caller. Your question was what, sir? You said rifle?
Yeah, they claim they found a rifle, and kind of been quiet now. They swept that under the carpet.
All right, let me, if you would, Mr. Allen, let me give you the background on that. The story by Matt McKinney, which really was poorly written in the Star Tribune, talks about the fact that the mother, let me just go back, caller, if I can, the mother and prime heir of Quincy Smith, Miss Betty Smith, has filed a suit in the federal court against the Minneapolis Police Department for the death of her son back in 2008. In that particular case, there was a domestic issue, and someone called on 911 and said that Mr. Smith, now deceased, had a rifle. The police officer that initiated the first contact with Mr. Smith and began the act of brutality had a previous legal action with Mr. Smith and had been involved in the beating of Mr. Smith 3 years before. Back in 2005, he had beaten him with some other officers and tasered him, etc. Anyways, the police reports, I'm well aware of this. I was a co-chair of the Police Community Relations Council reporting to the Department of Justice. There was supposed to be a rifle. I arrived at the scene that night. Of course, Mr. Smith was dead. He had been tasered, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 times, beaten, kicked, stomped. The police were conducting a search, and I remember asking the question, what were they looking for? They said a weapon. I assumed that normally in this town, after, you know, kill somebody, you normally plant a handgun. I later found out that night that it was a rifle, which was interesting. At about 10:30 the next morning, in fact, Mr. Smith was killed on a Friday evening, I had a conversation. I will not reveal who that conversation was with because we all are expecting to be called at trial, though I was never called before the grand jury. And I was told at around 10:30 that morning, which had to be, you know, 12 hours after or thereabouts after Mr. Smith had been killed, that a rifle had been found in a snowbank in an alley somewhat in close proximity to where Mr. Smith died. Oh, I wrote in one of my columns here in December of 2008 that rifle could not have been Mr. Smith's, that rifle had come from the property room of the Minneapolis Police Department's Northside Precinct. Now, in two conversations in which I was present at between the head of homicide and Miss Betty Smith, the question was asked about the rifle. She was told both in December of 08, January of 09, that they were still conducting an examination of the rifle that allegedly was in the hands of Mr. Smith, and that the scientific examination, including forensic and et cetera, had not yet come back. A year and a half later, when this matter finally went before a Hennepin County grand jury, the prosecutor very cleverly never talked about the rifle, and none of the grand jurors, of course, all white grand jury, by the way, which is not unusual here in Minnesota, no one ever asked about the rifle. So to your question, caller, there was never a rifle. And the one that was found was clearly never in the possession of Mr. Smith. It was a part of the continued cover-up that out of that, unfortunately, evolved his death at the hands of the police. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it did. Also, I read an article. So is it true now, Bill English and Fred Easter stealing computers and files from the City Inc.?
Well, let's get
well,
back.
We can't comment. Well, Mr. Allen, go right in, then I'll go ahead.
Okay. We have not named any names or pointed any fingers, but, yeah, there was a report from Channel 11, way before the Star Tribune produced a report, that computers, files, tax information, things like that were missing from the City Inc. It wasn't a forced entry. Go figure out the rest. Go ahead, Mr. Edwards.
Yes, sir. The cameras, the security cameras, did not work. They had been strategically tampered with, if you will. I'm aware of the fact that two journalists, two African-American journalists, confronted the Minneapolis Star Tribune just this week with the fact that they had done no follow-up. Star Tribune had done no follow-up on the events at City Inc., including some serious questions about a $600,000 loan, a audit report way back in 2008 that raised some serious questions about a real estate transaction on two pieces of property owned at that time by City Inc. Also, earlier this week, two African-American journalists, independent journalists, raised the question to the Star Tribune on why they had not done a follow-up on the events pertaining to City Inc. You named a gentleman by the name of English, if you will. Mr. English had a rather lucrative contract with the Minneapolis Public School District, number one, as in his role as headmaster of education, if you will, for now the now defunct City Inc. and et cetera. But others have named that. Also, we have to report that, as we first reported last week, sir, that checks for a criminal justice program that was being funded into City Inc. through the county and the federal government, that checks are bouncing all over the place. Young African-American men who had been enrolled in the program are finding themselves in dire financial shape. Some have lost their homes or getting ready to lose their homes. Checks for as large as $13,000. This is called the reentry program. It is a program which is, you know, legislatively developed, if you will. And the monies have disappeared. The checks are bouncing all over the place. Star Tribune has indicated it does not intend to write about it. And with the exception of Channel 11, as Mr. Allen pointed out, not a single other media touched the story of the so-called break-in. So, but we here at On Point haven't named anybody. We're merely talking in terms of information that has come forward relevant to documentation.
Yeah, well, the stink speaks for itself. And one more thing before I go. I mean, I think the blacks over north need to revolt just like they're doing in the Middle East there and run those leaders out of there. Thank you very much.
Mm. Thank you for the telephone call.
Thank you, sir. Oh, that's interesting.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, right. Wow. Yeah, reentry, by the way, is the program that the checks have been bouncing. A lot of young African-Americans are hurting right now because they were enrolled in the reentry program. They carried out their responsibilities, obligations, and et cetera. And there was a legal requirement to compensate them. And, man, I'm telling you, Don, the checks have been bouncing. When you get a check that bounces for $13,000, the person had to know that there was no money in the account.
Yes, exactly. He gave it to him and took off.
Yeah,
and Ms. Edwards, that also comes on the heels. You know, I had written a story a while back, talked about Minneapolis and the crime, and we've talked about Project Ceasefire and a couple other projects.
Safe Street. Let's play the machine gun.
Oh, yeah,
there.
Let's get the machine gun for Safe Street. Just a minute. Safe Street. Come on now. There we go. And a couple of these other projects. And on this Wednesday, the 16th of February, Yahoo Finance and U.S. News released a report that the 11 most dangerous cities. And Mr. Edwards, guess who showed up on that list?
Surprise me.
Okay, Minneapolis.
Minnesota.
It has St. Louis, Atlanta, Birmingham, Alabama, Orlando, Detroit, Memphis, Miami, Baltimore, Kansas City, Missouri, and Minneapolis actually tied for 10th with Cleveland.
Wow. Let me get this right, Mr. L. As one of 11 of the most dangerous cities in America?
Yes. The 11 most dangerous cities in America, Minneapolis is tied with Cleveland at number 10. Actually, Minneapolis is above Cleveland in the tie at number 10.
Well, we're puzzled here at On Point because during the mayoral race here in 2009, the now free-term mayor, R.T. Ryback, indicated that actually he had made this into one of the safest cities in America. And then they would roll out these FBI statistics, which everyone knew were, you know, being shaved, if you know what I'm saying. But the newspaper here in through 2010 would write stories and reports talking in terms of how safe our city was. We did a program back in May when we, being the only news media and entity here in Minnesota that dealt with it, talked about the whole Safe Streets program, and we had discovered, Mr. Allen, as you remember, information as it pertains specifically to the program identified as Operation Ceasefire, that there were some different kind of figures that the mayor and them were giving the League of Cities in putting together some reports talking in terms that Black America and Minneapolis, Black people, were suffering from a disease that pertained to crime. And that's a part of getting the mental health pieces and other kinds of legislation in place to be able to incarcerate even a greater number of African Americans here in Minneapolis and to a lesser degree in St. Paul. And so I'm not shocked, but let me repeat again, because they oftentimes say that we make these things up. This report was on Google from USA Today?
It was on Yahoo Finance from U.S. News. But if you want to read it right now, if you go to the Jordan Hochman Group, Google the Jordan Hochman Group, it's actually posted there in its entirety with a link to the Yahoo News and Finance site.
Okay.
And, it's sitting right there. They were nice enough to go ahead and publish it, I guess, right before the show here, so that we could give our listeners the opportunity to go see this, go click on the link. Because, you know, sometimes, Mr. Edwards, when you and I put information out and the Jordan Hochman Group put information out, so it comes in the Star and Tribune, it doesn't have any credibility. Okay, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
So now we have opportunity. We've been on top of it too many times, you know, reporting this scandalous stuff that's going on, and people are just, you know, just getting to understand that, okay, we might have something here, which, if you don't mind, kind of brings me to my next short topic here.
But right ahead.
Back in 2008, Mr. Edwards, I had done an extensive evaluation of Northway Community Trust and its executive director, Wesley Walker.
Okay.
I was concerned that Northway Community Trust and its executive director, Wesley Walker, had written a check for $50,000 and given it to a firm out of Chicago to do a survey on businesses that would work on Broadway Avenue in North Minneapolis. Now, Northway Community Trust is located at 1501 Broadway, West Broadway Avenue. And I thought that it was highly unusual that with all the Dr. Sam Myers here, University of Minnesota, Cura, St. Thomas, stakeholders in the community, why would Mr. Walker contract with someone, a company from Chicago, his friends, to come in and do this survey or research on businesses that would go good on Broadway Avenue? We know there's beauty salons, nail shops, barber shops, liquor stores, crack dealers, and what else? And churches on Broadway Avenue right now. So we've never gotten an opportunity to see this report. But here goes the Star and Tribune, who comes up with a story that says, it's titled, A 10-year lesson on how not to spend $200 million, a costly experiment to combat poverty, had some serious problems. And if those of you that read the story last Sunday, it didn't go online until this Wednesday of this week. But it's detailing out in the story of how these people, who in some cases have never run a shoeshine shop, have gotten this money, have access to $200 million over the last 10 years. And Mr. Edwards, I went as far back as to go back 10 more years, and the total amount is $500 million.
Yeah.
Okay. And it was initiated by the what I call the DFL political plantation in this case, to have a bunch of African-American social service agencies here in Minneapolis to focus on solving poverty.
Mm-hmm.
What, got $500 million floating around out there, and these guys are, Wesley Walker's giving the money to The Peace Foundation at shots of $500,000 a shot. And still, poverty is not solved, number one. Number two, they're paying for physicians. And now Northway Community Trust is located upstairs of the top floor, right above the Peace Foundation in Northwest, or North, was it the Northside Achievement Zone?
Now that's in the building at 1200 West Broadway.
1200 West Broadway, yes.
The building that also contains Tri Construction, who was very much involved in pass throughs on the Minnesota Twins stadium. Of a little over $2 million. When we say pass-throughs, they got the contract and they gave it back to the white contractors.
Yes.
And the black community never saw the money or saw the jobs. That's the same building. I call it the Crystal Palace of Infamy.
Yes. Exactly. And so, I mean, I'm just looking at the Star and Tribune story, which came late. We've known about this stuff since 2008. We've known about, and Mr. Edwards, you and I, and maybe one other person has been reporting, and most recently, this I keep mentioning the Jordan Hotman group because these guys have gotten on the ball and start really putting some the corruption that's going on in North Minneapolis in the streets.
I mean,
in a major way. And when you see it from their research point of view and how they write, you know, there's no denying that we have some issues here, not just with the political infrastructure, but with those spokespersons. I don't call them leaders anymore. I just call them spokespersons who are making decisions for people in North Minneapolis and residents. And these decisions are to maybe give $500,000 to the Peace Foundation. And then what does the Peace Foundation do with the $500,000? Well, they stop from focusing on crime and public safety. Then they move to education. But when they move to education, they pick some schools that are not performing well, and they're a stone throw away from North High, and they leave North High out of the pilot schools.
Right.
Which didn't make any sense to me at all. So with that said, we're wasting taxpayer money at the tune of $500 million, if not more, every 20 years.
Well, let me just correct, though, Mr. Allen. That's not taxpayer money. That's private philanthropic money.
Okay.
That's private philanthropic money. And the argument that I've heard for the last 15 years in community is that, you know, that's white folks' private money, and if they don't want to ask questions about how it's spent, it's okay. It's clearly not okay. I well remember when the Northwest Area Foundation, who had just changed its name, by the way, began that project. In fact, initially, their test project was in the Yakima Valley. Out in eastern Washington, around Richland and Yakima and Walla Walla and et cetera, and it basically was concentrating on poverty amongst migrant workers. And as they looked at that, somebody came up with the bright idea that we could move this into the urban areas of America, and they started looking, of course, at Montana, and then they moved here towards their own home base, Minnesota and the Dakotas. And in fact, I remember the first organizer that they sent into community. She was later to become councilwoman, and that was Natalie Johnson Lee. And I can never be 1999 and 2000. And I can remember all the meetings and secret meetings and et cetera that were going on and how the money was being positioned. In fact, Al McFarland, the editor, founder of the paper called Insight, received, I think, right off the top about $245,000. In fact, they had a kind of come to Jesus meeting at International Market Square there on Glenwood and Lindale. And for our international and domestic audience, International Market Square is a huge building that used to be the Munsingware facility, the Munsingware who makes, you know, T-shirts and slacks and things like that. And it's been converted into a big, massive office facility, and they have a nice little ballroom there. And I well remember in 2000 when McFarland was brought into play, and then his paper, Insight, began to talk about all the wonders of the Northwest Area Foundation's operation. And then the Northwest Area Foundation, about a year later, formed the Northway Trust. Am I correct?
Yes.
We should have the documentation, be able to call it up there here on computer. And then this Northwest Area Foundation came into play. And they began to control community for 7 or 8 years, just like Catalyst and the Achievement Zone and et cetera are doing now. Except you get these reports that can't be controlled that come out, like the one you talked about at the top of the program, that show that this city is more unsafe now than at any time in its history, certainly since the Depression and Prohibition.
Yes. Yes, and I mean, it's absolutely correct. There's just some weird stuff going on, and we're looking at this very closely and determining how Mayor R.T. Ryback is going to sweet-talk his way out of this. Because if you look at this report was done a while back, but it was published by Yahoo Finance, and this could have been one of the deciding factors for them not to have the Democratic convention up there.
Well, it was. It was. It was one of the things that it was the St. Louis delegation that responded to it, because St. Louis was confronted. See, St. Louis, as you remember, was also a contender. In fact, there was an article in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, I don't know, about 10 days ago. People in St. Louis are pretty hot because, actually, Minneapolis's delegation, led by R.T. Ryback, attempted to use the issue of Clean City and talked in terms of Minneapolis being clear. They almost came close to saying a nice, clean, white city, if you will. And so the folks in St. Louis were pretty ticked off, and apparently someone at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch was aware of this study. They got it, and lo and behold, I understand in the last hours of the presentations, St. Louis countered Minneapolis by indicating that this kind of information existed. And so what happened was Charlotte, North Carolina, who is going to host the Democratic National Convention, came out looking real clean.
Yeah, and then I'm glad they got it, because Minneapolis is going to start losing more stuff just because of what's going on here in the city. I just was pulling up, Mr. Edwards, I was on the computer in the other studio here, and let me just grab this here. I found a Minnesota Historical Society State Archives for the Council on Black Minnesotans, an inventory of published records and reports, which is, I guess, from this document in the Minnesota Historical Society and the Archives. And these reports range anywhere from African-American children, Minnesota, crime, foster care, politics and government. It's not a real – it's a two-page report. It's not detailed, but it looks like the last item that was in there, it was a report to the governor. What's really shocking about some of these reports that they have online right now, you can't actually find the report. I mean,
why am I not surprised? Yeah.
I've been all over the web looking for these reports, and I cannot find anything that even is close to what they're talking about on these PDF documents, as they're called.
Well, here's one of the problems in this particular situation, the Council on Black Minnesotans, which was established by legislative mandate. There has been a rumor for quite some time, and in 2008 here in Minnesota, the Minnesota Legislative Auditor, which is really the auditor for the Minnesota Legislature, not to be misidentified with the State Auditor, the Office of State Auditor, which is a constitutional office. The legislative auditor is an appointed position by the Minnesota legislature. And it's kind of like the Office of Budget in the federal government. They're pretty much nonpartisan, have an excellent reputation and credibility. In 2008, the legislative auditor, Mr. Noble, raised some serious questions about bogus reports. And the reason that it came up, Mr. Allen, and for our listening audience, national and international, it had to do with an examination of travel and other kind of expenditure.
Okay.
And so we're getting a little feedback, Mr. Allen. So what happened was the legislative auditor started asking for information. Well, then they began to connect the dots and the line and began to realize that if these meetings and things weren't taking place, then how did you reach the conclusion with respect to the report and examination of what was going on within Black Minnesota?
Yes. And so, yeah. That's
yeah, we're getting a little feedback there. We need to make sure we catch that.
Okay.
I was getting a little feedback, yeah. But go ahead. So that was the background of the Minnesota legislative auditor, and the internal auditor caught this. And so when you tell me that you're going to the website of the Council on Black Minnesotans, you can't find the reports and et cetera, I guess I'm not surprised. Lucky Rosenblum, the African American who is I guess still a member, because what we've had and I guess we should just move on into that also. We had a significant mass resignation from the council over the last 48 hours. Isn't that correct?
Yep, that is correct, Mr. Edwards. We had a mass exodus of. During Black History Month, we want to remind everyone, too, that it is still Black History Month. We have had a mass exodus of board members from the Council on Black Minnesotans to include Minneapolis Assistant City Attorney Martha Holton Dimmick, Secretary of the Council of Black Minnesotans Board, Lisa Jones, 180 Degrees Executive Director Catherine Walker, City of Minneapolis. What can I call him? They like him. So a guy that was liked by the City of Minneapolis, Donald Belfield.
Well, let me just clear, Mr. Belfield. In fact, we don't want to be laissez faire with that. Mr. Belfield is the chair of the powerful Police Civilian Review Authority, which does not find any. Or does not affirm any allegations against the police in this city. Mr. Belfield is the chair of the Minneapolis Civilian Review Authority.
Yes. And he was sitting until he resigned this week on the Council on Black Minnesotans. And so my question is, Mr. Edwards, to you, maybe you can help me understand, begin to wrap my mind about it, with all these heinous police actions. And not only is he sits on the chair of the Civilian Review Authority, but also as an executive committee board member of Council of Black Minnesotans, why isn't anything getting addressed?
Well, there's been discussions and during the 5 years existence of the Police Community Relations Council, actually forced upon the city by the Department of Justice, we approached the Council on Black Minnesotans about holding some public hearings because they had some authority that could have been meaningful. They declined, indicated for almost 5 years that they weren't interested. During that five-year time, just as we had a caller earlier, we had people like Quincy Smith, Fong Lee, Dominic Felder, and others, Mr. Jing. I mean, we had a whole host of African-Americans being killed here by the police under very questionable circumstances, and the council refused, right up until now, had refused to conduct any kind of public examination. Now, at one point, Senator Linda Berglund, who was the legislative representative, the law indicates that there will always be a state legislator who will be on the committee. For years it was Senator Linda Berglund, and she was asked, in fact an appeal was made to her by relatives or heirs, as we like to say, of African Americans who had been killed by the police here in Minneapolis, and they just turned a deaf ear. And so it's difficult for me to become upset in the sense that I know what has been at play. I know the kind of cover-up that has taken place, and I know that in some of the discussions, very heated discussions within the Police Community Relations Council, which we reported to the Department of Justice, that the chief here, particularly Tim Dolan, one of the things that he said and guaranteed to the mayor that there would be no institutions, and we're specifically talking about the Council on Black Minnesotans, the Minneapolis Civil Rights Commission, the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, and the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department, that these entities had already guaranteed that there would be no examination of police brutality and misconduct here.
Wow. So that means you don't have any rights anywhere, you don't have anyone to complain with, because certainly, Mr. Edwards, we do not have a functioning Department of Civil Rights here in the city of Minneapolis.
Definitely not. Definitely not.
So,
and you will see that with respect to the disparity study. And as we first announced here about 40 minutes ago on Point, there are secret meetings going on now. Velma Corbett, as we said, Tuesday morning at like 7:30, she'll have a meeting at the library, the public library, in a closed room, and they will be finalizing information that they have to give to the city clerk by the following morning. All of her recommendations, which are extremely favorable to big corporate and to corporate construction companies and et cetera, who are in the forefront, according to the disparity study, which the taxpayers of the city of Minneapolis paid $500,000 for that study. Her recommendations will basically put the baby, if you will, that being the communities of color, in the hands of the beast.
Mm.
And, you know, 2 weeks ago we talked in terms of Mr. Phillips, who had been positioned by the Dayton administration to look after economic development, et cetera. He was the head of the powerful construction company, Krauss Anderson. These folks have all gotten together over the last 5 or 6 or 7 months, if you will, and have dictated and said what it is that they expect. These are tough. Their position is these are tough times for white Minnesotans, and they have no energy, inclination, or compassion to deal with the fact that the African-American community has just been brutally violated, if you will. And so these are the things that are at play. Now, again, back to the Council on Black Minnesotans that started this discussion. That entity, in fact, as we talk right now, Mr. Allen, be advised that calls are going out around the metropolitan area trying to get names for Governor Mark Dayton to consider for appointment to the newly constituted Council on Black Minnesotans.
Mm.
And those conversations were going on early this morning. Telephone calls and et cetera are being made. The conversation basically goes along the line. Our operatives are intercepting these calls left and right, but the calls are along the lines that we want to get the right kind of Negroes into position so that the Dayton administration is not embarrassed by a do-nothing body.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And it's a sad commentary, but I put your finger extremely well and very eloquently on it when you talked in terms that there are no rights. It's like the doctrine of Taney, Justice Taney, that there are no rights that the Negro has that white folks are duty bound, morally bound, legally bound to recognize or to respect. And that's what the policy and the doctrine is here.
Yeah, and that brings us to our Mission Impossible moment here. One of my favorite parts. You know, Mr. Edwards, the theme music is playing in the background. Where does this put, you had touched on it a minute ago, where does this put Governor Martin? I mean, what kind of position? You know, they just passed the sunset law or legislation, 2.5 weeks ago. Is this an organization that maybe should be sunsetted or maybe should just be reorganized? And what do you think will be Governor Mark Dayton's role in getting this organization up and running besides fining?
Well, let me tell you some of the discussions that I'm being told are going on within the governor's office. And you have to you have to put the appropriate weight on it until you hear the governor himself. But one of the things that's happening is that the governor is concerned that the right image be displayed in advance, that he is a caring liberal governor. And so all of a sudden, even though they're asking for names for the appointments, if you will, the governor has asked his staff to suggest a committee approach. In other words, having some kind of community meetings to extract people's reflections and maybe even recommendations. The only problem is, we're now into month two. It'll be month three of the calendar year, and we will have a entity, which, by the way, though, the council still sits on that tobacco money.
Yes.
And there are individuals who were approached and asked about if they were interested in being on the council, and this is just in the last 24 hours here in Minnesota, who indicated they didn't have any interest because they had already cut deals to receive the annual $250,000 packet out of the $250,000 package goes money to the friends of the friends, if you will. And out of that packet is money as much as $50,000, and then the rest of them are increments of, you know, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $10,000, $5,000. It's amazing in the last 24 hours the number of people who said they weren't interested. I mean, these are the right kind of colored people, if you understand what I'm saying, who are saying that they aren't interested because they are expecting to be the recipients of $5,000, $15,000, $25,000 out of the so-called $250,000 tobacco allocation, annual allocation, if you will.
Well, you're saying they're going to get the money and just they're happy, they're comfortable where they're at, and there's no need for them to even be a part of that organization.
Well, that's definitely what they're saying, and they have enough sense to know that they do not want to get caught in the spotlight of conflict of interest. So they're just saying, give me the cut of the corrupt money that I'm supposed to get, and y'all do the best you can with trying to put the organization back into play and make it look functional. That's kind of the key statements right now that are being bantered about, is that we at least make the Council on Black Minnesotans look functional, if you will. Okay. Now, there is talk that on the other side of the aisle, Republican leadership laughing and smirking at what they call the Negro dance, if you will, are talking about the fact that they're going to possibly raise some tough questions when they get into probably in mid-March. Maybe those, notice how I put this, minor discussions about minority rights. And, of course, the Council, State Human Rights Department, which really the only two entities, will be asked some tough questions. Now, they will not sunset or try to sunset the Minnesota Department of Human Rights because of how it is created. But the Council on Black Minnesotans was created under a different statute and can be sunsetted. Mm-hmm.
Wow. And see, also with that, I was talking to a local businessman here in Minneapolis, and he had mentioned a few minutes ago about what's going on and everything with the legislator. This businessman told me that he's upset with our black elected officials at the state capitol. He's been doing business here in the Twin Cities for 40 years. He does not need to go through Representative Champion or Representative Hayden to get anything done. He's not really happy about the situation or the parameters they're setting up for people to do deals here in town.
Right. You know, you got to be careful. I mean, again, for those that of course, tune in and listen in or call the program up later, you got to be careful because you got a pretty tough federal United States attorney here, Todd Jones. And Mr. Jones, who is an African-American, is a straight-laced guy, very straight-laced, was in the provost marshals, advocate office in the Marine Corps as an attorney. And he's a pretty straight-laced. And if too many complaints start coming in that this Chicago-style politics is at work here, and that you got to find a friend of a friend who will then approach an elected public official or even an appointed public official if you want to get work or get contracts as it pertains to the state of Minnesota or the city of Minneapolis, because it's working both places. So the disparity study shows clearly African-Americans don't get contracts from the city of Minneapolis.
Yeah, and Mr. Edwards, we have a call.
Let's get it.
Go ahead, call. You're live on the air.
Or is that, would that be me?
That would be you, sir. What's your name, sir?
Lucky Rosenblum.
Welcome, Mr. Rosenblum.
Rosenblum, how you doing? What do you got?
Great, man.
All right.
Well, you know, obviously you guys are talking about the Council on Black Minnesotans, and obviously you know I'm a board member. Obviously you know I've been raising some of the same issues that you are talking about for the last 5 years about the Council on Black Minnesotans.
Correct.
Obviously, you know that I am not afraid to speak out because I've spoken out about certain issues and some of the things you guys are talking about for over 4 or 5 years in a Spokesman Recorder newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
I've also spoken out about those same kinds of things in some of our black churches and some of our community leaders. And I will stand up and say that in meeting with people at the state capitol. Let me back up. I don't know if you guys remember about 8 years ago, maybe 9 years, when then – we have House Republican Steve Sweegum, Tony Sutton, who now is the chair of the Minnesota Republican Party, then Eric Paulson, who is now on a national level, then Tim Pawlenty, who was in the House.
Yeah, Eric Paulson, the congressman. Right, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, to make it short, about 8 or 9 years ago, there was a move to shut down the council.
Correct.
There were 4 or 5 Republicans and 3 or 4 Democrats. With my talking to Eric Paulson and some other Republicans, and then House member Tim Pawlenty, I actually got the Republicans to back off that move.
Mm-hmm.
I actually got them to back off, and that only left the DFL, Democrats, who are supposed to be our friends, that were still there to shut down the council, but without the Republicans, they kind of lost that battle. Then I had Eric Paulson, Steve Sweekin, other House members who actually went up to the Council on Black Minnesotans. Let me finish. Who actually went up to the Council on Black Minnesotans, sat down with Lester in the conference room, and we made a deal. And that deal was before the Republican Party would introduce a bill that they would involve the Council on Black Minnesotans to help create that bill and take out anything that might be adversarial to the black community. The council never followed up. At that point, I was not a board member. I was just someone in the community, in the Republican Party, president of the Black Republican Coalition, who worked out one of the best deals for the council that the council could have had, where Republicans said, we are going to be here at the table. You can be here with us when we create these bills and remove anything that you think is adversarial to the black community. The council never followed up.
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct, Mr. Allen. Let me just say, Lucky's absolutely correct. I well remember that. In fact, I talked about it on my television programs back in the day, and I'm also aware, because both he and I are columnists for the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, Lucky took some real hits and some real attacks from people because he was bringing this information forward. Go ahead, Lucky.
And I also brought the audits forward in my column. Now, I want to say this. People on the council, the board, were fighting me, calling me names, trying to oppress me, trying to subjugate me. There were African-American so-called leaders who even sent a letter to Governor Pawlenty asking Governor Pawlenty to remove me from the board. Governor Pawlenty pretty much sent a letter back saying, I appointed Lucky because he's a change agent. He's going nowhere.
Right.
Governor Pawlenty, other Republicans that I've talked to, that I'm talking to right now, are looking for leadership from the council. In fact, I sent a letter out a few years ago to all the House members, and I said, when was the last time you all seen anyone from the Council of Black Minnesotans down here to talk about any bill? Five or six or seven responded, and I took this back to the Council of Black Minnesotans board, and I said, look, you guys, here's the information I got back. It's unwritten. It's in paper. They're telling me in the last year and a half they haven't seen anyone down here. The only time they saw someone down there was the director when it was about the Council of Black Minnesotans budget, and then they told me he wasn't prepared, so they gave him a chance to come back, and he still wasn't prepared. People at the legislative House members, Senate members, they do not respect the council because of what's going on with these audits. They do not respect the council because when the council comes down there, what little times they do, the feedback from both Republicans and Democrats that I talked to, they say they're not prepared, they're illiterate, they're not prepared, and it's sad.
Lucky, let's do this for our listening audience, both domestic and international. Give us your appointment and tenure on the council, because as you pointed out, initially you were not a member. You became a member when? And
I became a member about six years ago, and I was reappointed by Governor Pawlenty.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was reappointed, House members, both Democrats and Republicans, and I got all the emails, I got the letters to prove it, because you know I say things, were talking about shutting down the council. Right now, I have House members, Republicans, that I talked to last week that I've emailed. And over the last month, they're saying, Lucky, we're about to do something now. And I'm like, wait a minute. I was down there just last week. I was down at the Capitol saying, we have some board members that I thought were a part of the problem. Martha Dimmick was a part of the problem. Miss Jones was a part of the problem.
You see, the problem with the council, it just depends. If you're a council member, depending on who comes up with an idea will depend if that idea is a good idea or a bad idea. I also apologize to Reverend Stanton. I apologize to Bill English. I apologize to Reverend McAfee because those brothers came up to the council. They walked in. They were prepared. They were not disrespectful. They walked in. They asked questions. And every time they asked a question, before they could get an answer, Martha Dimmick, the chair, Martha Dimmick would call on someone else. Martha Dimmick, Lisa Jones, Don Belfield, one other board member, I can't remember his stupid name right now, they were so disrespectful to these brothers, okay? Mm-hmm. The brothers were just asking questions. They wanted an answer. Now, look, when I was a teenager, when I was in my 20s, I saw Bill English, Ron Edwards, Mike Moss, McAfee, Stanton. I saw those brothers fighting for me as a young man to be able to grow up and even be on the doggone council, and for those brothers to come into the council with the tradition they have in the community, fighting for our rights is nothing glorious. Ron, you know that.
Oh yeah,
I know that.
I know it well. Yeah,
I know. No, I know that because I fight for our rights now. You brothers kind of paid me the way to do the doggone things. This is no glorious business we're in. And then you come to the council on Black Minnesotans and be disrespected like that.
Right.
When Martha Dimmick said adjourn, let's adjourn this meeting, I quickly said I want a roll call because I wanted the community to know every board member that voted to kick these brothers out of the council, to walk out on these brothers that have sacrificed their lives and their families for our people.
Right.
I wanted the community to know. That's why I asked for a roll call vote. I want everybody to be man enough, woman enough to stand here and say yes or no to these brothers that you're trying to kick out of this council. And they got up, Don Belfield, Lisa Jones, got up and walked out on these brothers.
Oh, is that right? Okay. All right. Yeah.
Do you know how hurtful that was?
Oh, yeah.
That was
and this
hurtful.
Is the council
was,
on Black Minnesota.
Black Minnesota.
I understand what you're
and
saying.
Listen. And before they came, I sent an email out to the community. I sent an email out to the board members. I even sent an email to you, Don, saying when these brothers come to this meeting, they are our constituents.
That's why
Mr.
Allen was at the meeting that night. Right. We've got to ask you this because for purpose of transparency. Tell us a little bit in our listening audience a little bit about the tobacco fund.
Well, I don't want to talk about that right now.
Oh,
because
okay.
I understand that you all may have some issues with that. I don't want to talk about that right now, but what I do want to say and what I do want to talk about is this. The way that Randy Stanton, and understand the council had no power to really reject Randy or tell Randy he couldn't speak. Randy was man enough to pull himself out because of the controversy a few board members on the council had started. I'm going to tell you how that went down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That night in the council meeting, a board member came in and said and distributed about two or three pages of information that she probably pulled off the internet about Randy Stanton. The question was asked, is there anything recent? We were led to believe that there was recent criminal activity. Now, when you got a county city prosecutor and you got other credible, so-called credible people telling you there's recent stuff, and then all of a sudden Randy comes to the next board meeting and tell us that was 20 years ago. I'm like, well, you guys are telling us he has some recent stuff. So if we believe that there's some recent criminal stuff, people of ordinary prudence would say we have to put this on hold for the best interest of what we're trying to do. We were misled.
Are you saying that an assistant city attorney is the one that brought the information in that was allegedly information taken out of the criminal files
No, Ms. Jones brought that information in.
Oh, Ms. Jones brought
the question. The question is, where did she get it from?
Mm-hmm. Well, my
with
sense
that,
is, like your long experience tells me, she got it from Martha.
With that, Martha attested to what Ms. Jones was saying.
Oh, that's a egregious
member,
violation. Yeah, Reverend Stanton should get an attorney and sue on that. Mm-hmm.
A member, and I'll be the first ones that he doesn't even have to subpoena me. I will come voluntarily. One board member even asked, who is a public defender and a lawyer, even asked, is there anything recent?
Yeah.
We were led to believe there was recent things that he's involved in.
So now, those were some of the questions. Those were some of the questions then that Reverend McAfee and others were raising a couple Tuesdays ago when unfortunately the police had to be called.
They were raising those questions in a very respectful way. You see, we have some board members that are afraid. One board member now who is the vice chair, in my opinion. You see, the reason I'm not afraid to say anything is because these are public people. Public people, you can talk about public people. I'm not afraid.
Mm-hmm.
We have one board member, in my opinion, who has little experience with black people in the black community. As a matter of fact, after they walked out, myself and another community member who was there was asking his brother about some things in the community and what was going on. He was clueless. And because Reverend Stanton and McAfee, you know, when those brothers stand up, they're cogent brothers. They're forceful brothers. Their appearance makes them forceful. When they stand up and talk, the vice chair, Robert Martin, looked like he was afraid of these brothers and wanted to adjourn because, in his opinion, these brothers were getting violent. I'm like, man, who schooled you that all black men are violent? Because we stand up, we can say what we want to say. We are direct. We can say what's in our mind. I like, dude, you don't even know McAfee. McAfee sat down and back of me and said, Lucky. He even asked me. McAfee sat down and said, Lucky, am I being disrespectful? Because he wanted to check in with me.
Who called him? Was it public defender Martin or the assistant city attorney?
No.
Who called the St. Paul police?
No. Afterwards, myself, a couple community members were in the boardroom talking. And we heard this sister yelling in the hallway, leave me alone, leave me alone. From her voice, you can obviously tell she was a reluctant participant.
Mm-hmm.
Myself, two other members ran out in the hallway expecting to break up a fight. When we got there, this particular sister who called the police, I won't say her name because I never say a victim's name, called the police. Well, she was visibly shaken. A community member told her that if she felt the way she was feeling, she needed to call the police. Obviously, at that time, she was so shaken. She was in fear, immediate fear. She felt she needed to call the police.
All right. Look, let's ask this question as we start to come up. What is your take on what is the future? Because we've been talking about that quite a bit before you call. What is your take? What is the future of the Council on Black Minnesota?
Well, here's what I'm doing. Because I know there are church groups that are talking about the council. I know Reverend Stanton, rightfully so. Reverend McAfee, rightfully so. Bill English, rightfully so, are talking about the council. I know I got House members talking about the council, and they're not all Republican, excuse me. I am asking the community, now that I've got some of these people off the board, they're gone. I'm asking the community to give me an opportunity to put us on a 7-month rebuild the council plan. To rebuild a council that reflects the community and the needs of the community. And the first way that I would like for that to happen is for brothers like you, Ron, Don, Reverend McAfee, to hold a community forum, not to pat me on the back, because I don't need people patting me on the back, but a community forum to say, this is what we think about you. I almost said something, you colored people, you people, whatever. But this is what we think about you all. This is what we believe you are not doing. This is what we believe you are out of touch with the community. And that if we are about leadership, if we are about representing our community, our constituents, we would take that information back to the council as a board, reorganize, and reflect the community.
Okay.
And be at the Capitol. Okay? Now, let me tell you something.
Mm-hmm.
some, not all, I find people either love me, like Reverend McAfee said it at the meeting. He stood up, he says, Lucky, I'm like you. And he said it right in front of the board. People love me or they hate me.
Right, right.
But he says, if I go to St. Paul, and if I want to know what's happening with black people in St. Paul, Reverend McAfee said, I'm going to go to Lucky.
Yeah, okay. All
we
right, Mr. Allen.
Members.
Gotcha. Okay. I hear you. Mr. Allen, any questions from you? Because I think that's a good recommendation that Lucky has made for ecumenical leadership and others to get it together. And there needs to be at least a public hearing on the future of the Council on Black Minnesota. I think that's agreed. Mr. Allen, you have any questions? Go ahead.
Yeah, I was, Mr. Rosenblum, I was just looking at some of the audit information, and I just had my calculator out. I don't know if you guys heard me on the back end there tapping my calculator. I'm just seeing a, looks like what it is, between a $26 to $29 deficit or a misappropriation.
Ooh.
Or some money missing here. Is that something that you could speak on or aware of?
Well, it's all public information. When I was at the council, when I've been on the board, I found that there were some members who were paid some money that they should not have been paid.
Mm.
I was responsible for contacting the Attorney General's office, and I was really hard in pushing to make those board members pay that money back, and I did it.
Okay.
That's accountability.
Now, this is not staff. We're not talking about, Lucky, we're not talking about staff. We're talking about commission members receive remunerations and compensation and et cetera.
You're talking,
is that right?
You're talking about what I was talking about in the spokesman, and that is money that's unaccounted for, that's money that was used suspiciously, and to this day, I don't believe that money has really ever fully been accounted for.
Hmm.
The only thing I can do as a board member, I am the senior board member. All the other board members now have just been appointed. I am the senior board member. I have more history on that board than any other board member. The question is, they need to sit their butts down and listen to someone who knows the community, who knows what's been going on in the council, who sees this pattern repeating over and over again and saying, you all have to stop it, because you cannot claim that this stuff happened before you came, but you've been here for a year and you're still allowing it to happen. Now you are a part of it. I cannot be the only voice standing up, speaking on these issues, which is why I think people like you, Don, Ron, other people in the community have respect for me, because now they're seeing some of these things that I'm saying is true. At one point, I think people were saying, and maybe board members were spreading the word, Lucky's just a troublemaker.
Right. Let me ask you a question, something you just said minutes ago. Have the vacancies been filled already? Has the governor already filled the vacancies?
No, but let me tell you what's happening. Okay? Mm-hmm. The old clique, and I believe, my opinion, Robert Jones, the interim vice chair, who thinks he can just get a position as chair now.
Now, is it Robert Jones or Robert
chair,
Martin?
Robert Martin, I'm sorry, Robert Martin,
who is the vice
chair, who thinks that he can just move into the chair position now that the chair left. I'm like, no, dude, we're going to have elections now.
Right.
But my point is that he already said we have the applications we want to send to the governor's office. Dude, that's not how we do it.
Yeah, the reason, let me just say this, Lucky, so that you're clear, and again, we work very closely with transparency here on this program. The reason I said that is because, and we actually said it maybe before you turned us on, the reason I asked the question is that I was puzzled by the fact that all through the early part of today, Lester Collins, the director, has been making calls to strategically placed individuals as they identify asking them to recommend individuals for the council. So it's interesting your comment
is
right on point.
That is what I'm saying.
Okay.
You can't keep appointing cronies. You can't keep appointing people that you know so that when you come on the board, okay, you're already going to be a part of the same old BS. And what I said to Robert Martin is, this stuff, nonsense about you guys already got names you're sending in, that Martha Dimmick or whoever wants to send in, that's not how this thing works.
The way this thing works is that we sent a notice out in the Minnesota Sportsman Recorder, Inside News, KMOJ Radio. Wherever we got to send a notice out, we've put a notice, PSA, there are board openings, and you don't have to call Lester for that. You go online, you call the appointment coordinator in the governor's office, and get your application in.
Right, okay. All right, we got about two more minutes. Any other pieces you want to get in? Because we may have some callers, other callers waiting.
Yeah,
Go ahead, Lucky.
Yeah, I'm just, and I'll stay on to listen to the callers. But I am asking the community to give me 7 months. You all know me. You know how I am. You know I don't play games. You know I don't play double standards. You know I'm going to tell it like it is. Give us 7 months to rebuild this council, and if we don't rebuild it, the credibility in 7 months, do what you got to do to end the doggone thing.
All right. Well, Mr. Allen, anything else? And Lucky, we appreciate it. We appreciate the information and the depth and the insight.
Yeah, so we really appreciate that. That's something that we need to get out and let our listeners, listening audience know about. We really appreciate the telephone call, Mr. Rosenblum. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, sir. All right.
You're welcome.
Okay. Mr. Allen, you're thinking, and by the way, let's give that number again. We have about 14 minutes, right?
14 minutes here.
Yeah, because I'd like to hear some calls from some of the folk that we know are listening in, who know all about this situation. But give me your thinking. We'll be right out front, transparent here on Point. 7 months. Now, let me just say this. I think that that's actually a little too long. I think that the authorities, the appointing authority, needs to make a decision in about, because we've got all kinds of things that are happening to the African-American community here in the state of Minnesota. And when you have an entity or a body in place, then they need to be doing their job. But I can appreciate that at least Lucky has a plan. But go ahead, yeah. Your thinking, sir.
Well, you know, this has been a long time coming. Again, I had a conversation, like I was saying earlier, with this businessman who's been doing business here for 40 years. And I don't want people that are listening to this program to think that our goal is to crush and destroy this entity set up originally to assist the people of color here in the state of Minnesota, especially black people. But if the organization is not functioning, we have to look into it and adjust and tweak and make it work. At this point, it's not working. Do we want it shut down? No. Do we want it working? Yes. Is there things that they should be addressing? Are there things they're going to miss? Of course. I mean, we got this disparity report, which is huge. But, you know, we counted on having the assistant city attorney, Martha Holton Dimmick, up there as chair of the Council on Black Minnesotans to bring the disparity report to the council and have them address it. But when you asked her about it, she says, well, I do criminal things. I didn't know about that.
Yes, she did. Yes, she did. And we reported that on a couple of occasions over the last 6 weeks here on Point. So that if there's any question about the authenticity of what we just said, it's on record. But go ahead, sir.
We have another call here, Mr.
Oh, let's get them. Let's get them. Let's get them in. We're encouraging
yes, caller. You're live on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, this is Mustafa calling from Minneapolis.
Hey, Mustafa, what's on your mind?
All right. I have a question for both of you. Council of Black Minnesotans, what's the difference between this organization and many other non-profit or governmental entities that claim to be representing, you know, people, and they do more harm than anything else, whether that's a CRA or civil rights, or I don't see any difference, and I don't think they will.
Okay,
Masaba, we appreciate
that, and let us give you a response to that. And Mr. Allen, if you don't mind, I'll handle that, and then you come in. But Mustafa will respond to it.
Go ahead.
His question is well, it's well grounded. The group that he named, of course, came out of the struggle by the black community, by black America, as it pertains to the injustices. So the council, the civil rights department, the human rights office, the federal entities, all of them began to emerge around the late 1940s, and it started with housing. By the 1960s, we were having in this country the same kind of uprisings now that you're seeing in the Middle East and other places. And the government decided it needed to at least make the appearance that there was something structured, because prior to that, other than than the issue of housing. There was nothing that was really structured, and people, well, for our purposes, Mr. Allen, here locally, people like Cecil Newman, Nellie Stone Johnson, Father Denzel Carty, a whole host of African-American Negro leaders and et cetera, had been carrying this battle on without a structured kind of setting. And coming out of the 1960s, we had these structured organizations. Now, I was one of those, as at that time I was the chairman of the board of the Urban League of Minneapolis. I was a part of the delegations that went over, that met with a number of individuals. There was only one black state legislator left at that time. That was Randolph Staton, but there were other legislators who were involved in drafting the legislation. And so out of that came the Council on Black Minnesotans, the administrative arm, and et cetera. So to Mustafa's question, these entities were created as a part of the federal government and state governments having to address the grievances of black Americans. And, of course, over the years, others who have come to this great nation, if you will, have been able to enjoy all the vestiges, if you will, of the so-called legislation. The problem is that too many folks have let us down, and I think that Lucky articulated that extremely well. You continue, Mr. Allen, to point out the role of an assistant city attorney who, as a legal practitioner, okay, where we're going with Latin definition, et cetera, as a legal practitioner, she should have known better when she told us here on Point that she dealt with the criminal end of the city attorney's office. She didn't know anything about this particular study, which raises serious questions legally and criminally, by the way, Mr. Allen, as you know and I know, criminally with respect to how things are being done in the city of Minneapolis. So when Martha did that, she was in fact violating canons of law, because that was an inappropriate misrepresentation of her responsibility and obligation under color of law. So hopefully we've answered Mustafa's question.
Okay, Mustafa. Anything else?
Yeah, thank you, thank you. I just want to say I know the original intention was good, and to, you know, to correct the many mistakes that people suffered for so many years. But I think now, in general, all these organizations, you know, do the opposite, and they are using it just to frustrate people, you know.
You're absolutely correct. Let me just say this to you also, Mustafa, let me, if you can, as a part of history, because this is Black History Month, as they say. This period that we're going through here in Black America is not the first time, because unfortunately, after the initiations of what were called the Black Codes, after the compromise of 1876, when Black Americans, when the Negro thought that we had achieved freedom in this nation, and then there was a total reversal. In fact, we'll be talking about that, Mr. Allen, on our program on cable tomorrow on MTN. But, Mustafa, understand that the heartache for Black America has been that we went through this once before. We thought we had organizational structure in place. We thought that the law was in our favor. We thought that there was a new dawn, and et cetera. And within 20 years, less than 20 years, we found ourselves almost back to where we were before the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863. Tragically, we now find ourselves further behind the eight ball than we were in 1965, 100 years later, with respect to our expectations. Key word for me, Mr. Allen and Mustafa, is the expectation of the sons and daughters of the African with respect to what we thought was going to happen, what was going to make life better for us, which was going to give us the opportunity for greater successful pursuit, and et cetera. This is the second time. This is the second time that Black America has been betrayed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mustafa, for the call.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Mr. Allen, your thoughts, man. What do we got about 7 minutes? Go ahead.
7 minutes left, yes, sir. Again, that number is 877-572-4288. And again, 877-572-4288 is the number if you'd like to call in, leave a comment, suggestion, whatever. It's unfortunate that, you know, first of all, I really got my eyes opened again. You know, you have these awakenings, and you have to remember that here in Minneapolis, unlike South Carolina, North Carolina, New York, Detroit, Denver, Seattle, L.A., and a lot of those places. The black folks here, Mr. Edwards, first of all, do not want to do business with black folks. Okay?
Correct, yeah.
The Minneapolis Public School Board, or Minneapolis Public Schools District 1, is a $700 million organization with mostly white vendors.
That's correct.
And the problems they're having are affecting the children of color. And people that said I have been a critic of the Minneapolis Public Schools, it's more so a critic of a process and a critic of education and the process of education as it is delivered to children of color when they go to these schools every day and they don't see people that look like them.
Absolutely.
And so getting back up to Mustafa's point is you have all these duplicate agencies. All of them are dependent on a government program to solve a problem. There is no creativity. There is no ingenuity or anything to – and I'm going to let the caller – we have another caller here.
Let's get him. Let's get him. Let's get him.
Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Allen. Don't you
yes,
have a
sir.
Contract with the school district?
Yes, I do.
How much?
I am a private business, and it's public information. You can call the school district and ask them why. What's your point?
Well, yeah, we need to know. It's public, so tell us how much.
Well, why don't you call the school district? I mean, what's your point?
You talk about everybody else, but you don't want to disclose yours.
I just shouldn't have to. It's public. It's already on the internet. Google my name, and we have a public school. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. So he ain't had nothing to say, and he's calling back. And this time I got the number. But anyway, Mr. Edwards, getting back to the point, is that I told the people at the school district, because I called them last week and I asked the department, I had been going and filming for the last 2 weeks at the new Crystal Palace, the Minneapolis Public School headquarters that they're building. And after reviewing my almost 45 minutes of film, I saw not one person of color in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, okay, that's a problem. So I called up the Cedric and James Burrow at the Department of Diversity and Equity at the Minneapolis Public Schools, and I just asked them real quick. I said, hey, who's going to own the district headquarters when it's done? Who did the insurance and the bonding? And Cedric was quick to tell me, oh, yeah, we're going to own it. And I said, can you send that to me in writing?
You mean Cedric from the district told you that? Did he wasn't
yes.
aware that in a education election forum that you and I hosted at UROC in October of last year, that candidates for the school board, including an incumbent, and in fact it was T. Williams, indicated to us that the district would not own the building for 20 years.
Yeah.
Cedric didn't know that.
No, he did not know that. And so I just asked him for it in writing. The thing is, you know, I went into the school district for that last caller, and I went into the school district after with 2 minutes remaining. And I'll run right through this real quick. I says, you know what? I told him last October 25th, I've been traveling out of town, over out of the country, back in the United States. And everywhere I went, every school district, or everywhere that I went, I sat down, turned on the TV, and there was a commercial for the local public schools.
Uh-huh.
There were print ads in the newspapers.
Uh-huh.
I went ahead and did a print campaign for them, and I exceeded their expectations. Now, if you're worried about the measly money that I got for doing this to actually fulfill a task, you need to look at the public service contracts over the last 5 years that will show millions of dollars. And you can close your eyes and point on one of them contracts, and you have to ask where it is. But with that said, Mr. Edwards, we have 90 seconds left. Is there anything in closing?
We've already indicated the program on MTN. We'll be talking in terms of some, again, additional historical kinds of things. We continue to revisit the massacre at Colfax, Louisiana on April 5th, 1873. We would encourage people to obtain the book, certainly listen to the program, get an education on how black history disappears, unfortunately. I think they're just a great program. I think that we certainly want to invite, again, that we've extended the invitation to Lester Collins. Mr. Collins, feel free to call him.
Okay, yes, please. We open the invitation. Again, you've been listening to On Point with your co-hosts, Don Allen and Mr. Ronald A. Edwards, here on Point. We'll be back next Saturday at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time. We ask you to tune in, call in, participate. And for those of you listeners that are out there that are listening currently online, next week, you know, take the opportunity to pick up the phone, give us a call. I mean, we'd love to have a conversation with you and find out what you're thinking. And, again, this is not an effort to tear down the community, but an effort to build up the community and understand why for so many years, especially here in the Twin Cities, we have not managed to get beyond a White Castle mentality. And we need to do better than that. Again, you're listening to On Point. We'll be back next week. And don't forget to check out the Spokesman Recorder with Mr. Ron Edwards, our article in it, and Independent Business News Network.
All right. In fact, the article talks about the Council on Black.
Free at last! Free at last! Thank God Almighty! We are free at last!